Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Hosea chapter 12, which I will entitle The Lord's Indictment of Israel and Judah. Now, in our last chapter, chapter 11, Yahweh has indicated his love for Israel, and except for the last verse in that chapter 11, he's spoken very nice things about Israel. But now he's going back to the denunciations, the well-deserved denunciations. Both of Israel, he's going to throw Judah in too in this chapter. Now, we need to really start out with the last verse of Hosea 11, which properly belongs at the head of chapter 12. Hosea 11:12 says, Ephraim surrounds me with lies, and the house of Israel with deceit. Judah is also unruly against God, even against the Holy One who is faithful. So you see, Ephraim, northern Israel, and Judah are blasted in the last verse of Hosea 11, and the denunciations continue in chapter 12. And of course, Hosea is prophesying sometime before the fall of northern Israel to Assyria in 722 BC. So we start now in verse 1 of Hosea 12. Ephraim feeds on wind and pursues the east wind continually. He multiplies lies and violence. Moreover, he makes a covenant with Assyria, and oil is carried to Egypt. Now, why does Ephraim, northern Israel, feed on wind? Because he labors in vain, as Gil says. You try to get any sustenance out of eating wind, you're going to come away hungry. Ephraim pursues the east wind continually. Now, the east wind was and still is, as Adam Clark says, in all countries, a parching, wasting, injurious wind. But that's what northern Israel is feeding on. Ephraim multiplies lies and violence. Moreover, he makes a covenant with Assyria. That's referring to 2 Kings 17:3. Shalmaneser, the fifth king of Assyria, attacked him, and Hoshea became his vassal and paid him tribute money. Now, Barnes and Ellicott back that up. They quote the contents of 2 Kings 17:3 and say that's what Hosea is referring to here, this alliance with Hoshea and Assyria. Next, at the end of verse 1, Hosea says, oil is carried to Egypt. Now, Israel was famous for olive oil, as Barnes says, as is well known, actually. And he sent oil as a present to So, king of Egypt, at the time that Egypt was a tributary to Assyria. In other words, Hoshea, the last king of northern Israel, and So, the pharaoh of Egypt, are plotting rebellion against Assyria. And that, of course, brought on northern Israel's ruin, because Shalmaneser V is not going to put up with that. The Assyrians aren't going to put up with that. And so they came in and attacked. We read about this in 2 Kings 17:4. But the king of Assyria discovered Hoshea's conspiracy. He had sent envoys. Hoshea, the last king of Israel, had sent envoys to So, king of Egypt, and had not paid tribute money to the king of Assyria as in previous years. The king of Assyria was Shalmaneser V. Therefore, the king of Assyria arrested him and put him in prison. Now, Barnes and Ellicott back that up too, saying that the oil being carried to Egypt is a reference to Hoshea trying to make an alliance with So, as described in 2 Kings 17:4. We go now to Hosea 12, verses 2 through 6. The Lord also has a dispute with Judah, not only northern Israel, but Judah, the southern two tribes. And the Lord will punish Jacob according to his ways. He will repay him according to his deeds. Now, that Jacob there could refer to the northern ten tribes only, which is what it usually does. Barnes and Ellicott hold that view, but pulpit commentary and Poole say that it refers to all the 12 tribes. I don't think it's all that important which way we go on that. So starting over with verse 2, the Lord also has a dispute with Judah and will punish Jacob according to his ways. He will repay him according to his deeds. In the womb he took his brother by the heel, and his maturity he contended with God. Yes, he wrestled with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought his favor. He found him at Bethel, and there he spoke with us. Even the Lord, the God of hosts, the Lord is his name. Therefore, return to your God, observe kindness and justice, and wait for your God continually. Now, what Hosea is doing here, he starts out by saying the current descendants of Jacob, in other words, the northern ten tribes, possibly all 12 tribes, but let's say the northern ten tribes, they're the descendants of Jacob, and they're going to get punished. And then Hosea contrasts the actions of present-day Jacob with the original Jacob. In verse 3, that original Jacob, while he was in the womb of his mother, Rachel, he took Esau, his brother, by the heel, and that showed that Jacob really wanted the birthright, even when he was a little infant, a fetus. He wanted the birthright. He was concerned about God's matters. And in his maturity, he contended with God. So Jacob grew up, and he contended with God when, in verse 4, he wrestled with the angel, the famous story there. Jacob is wrestling to get a blessing from God, which is in sad contrast to present-day Israel, who does not care about God and would not think about wrestling with God for a blessing. Let's read the biblical passages that tell us about this. First of all, Jacob's grabbing by the heel in order to get the birthright. Genesis 25:25-26. The first one came out red-looking, that's Esau, covered with hair like a fur coat, and they named him Esau, which means red. After this, his brother came out and grasping Esau's heel with his hand. That was Jacob grabbing Esau's hand. So he was named Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when they were born. So Jacob was a hero even in the womb because he wanted the birthright, in contrast with the present sad state of Israel. Now Jacob grows up, and he ends up in this famous wrestling match with the angel of Jehovah all night long at the Jabbok River. He's struggling to get a blessing from God as he wrestles with God, wrestles with the angel of Jehovah, whom I assume is Jesus. Again, that's in contrast to present-day Jacob, present-day Israel, which doesn't care about God. We read about this wrestling in Genesis 32, verses 24 through 28. Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When the man saw that he could not defeat him, he struck Jacob's hip socket as they wrestled and dislocated his hip. That, of course, is to show that Jacob's flesh was broken, his natural strength was broken, only by God's might is he going to prevail. Verse 26, then he, that's the angel of Jehovah, said to Jacob, let me go, for it is daybreak. But Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. Now Jacob must have realized he was wrestling with some supernatural being here, and he wanted to get blessed. What is your name? The man asked. The angel of Jehovah asked. Jacob, he replied. Your name will no longer be Jacob, he said. It will be Israel, because you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed. So Jacob is struggling. Israel means struggle. Jacob is struggling to get a blessing, unlike present-day Israel, which could not give a flying rip about Yahweh. We continue with the story of Jacob after he wrestles with the angel at the river Jabbok, where he wept and sought the angel of Jehovah's favor, crying about it, seeking God's favor, and then, at a later instance, on his way to Syria to find him a wife, Jacob found Yahweh at Bethel, the house of God, famous place north of Jerusalem, and there God spoke with us. Now that us is awfully confusing to me. That's the NASB translation. The Holman Christian Study Bible has him. So Jacob wept and found Yahweh at Bethel, where Yahweh spoke with him, with Jacob. Now, this is the famous story of Jacob's ladder. It was there at Bethel that God made those glorious promises to Jacob relative to his posterity. Genesis 28:13-15 says this, Yahweh was standing there beside him, saying, I am Yahweh, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. Now, this is in the dream of, or the vision of Jacob's ladder. Yahweh says, I will give you and your offspring the land that you are now sleeping on. Your offspring will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out toward the west, the east, the north, and the south. All the peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. Land, offspring, and blessing. Those are the promises to Abraham being re-promised to Abraham's descendant Jacob. Yahweh continues, look, I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go. I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. So there's your vision of Jacob's ladder. So what Hosea is doing here is going through the marvelous history of Jacob and showing how Jacob really wanted the birthright. He was really concerned about Yahweh. He actually wrestled with God to get blessed. He grabbed his brother Esau's heel to get the blessing of God, and then he wrestled with the angel of Jehovah to get the blessing of God. And then he gets prophesied about getting a blessing of God, a blessing that will cover the whole earth at Bethel, at Jacob's ladder. Contrast all that with these pathetic northern Israelites, the Ephraimites, who could care less about God. Verse 5 says, even the Lord, the God of hosts, the Lord is his name. Therefore return to your God, observe kindness and justice, and wait for your God continually. So Hosea throws out an exhortation to the northern Israelites of his day, the 8th century northern Israelites, and Judah too. I keep forgetting they're involved in this too in verse 2. All of you guys, you need to come back to God. Didn't do any good. Northern Israel went down in 722 to the Assyrians, and southern Israel, Judah, went down to the Babylonians in 586. We go down to Hosea chapter 12, verses 7 through 8. A merchant in whose hands are false balances, he loves to oppress. And Ephraim said, surely I have become rich. I have found wealth for myself. In all my labors they will find in me no iniquity, which would be sin. He loves to oppress. The he is referring to Ephraim there. Hosea is not very impressed with the current moral state of the northern Israelites. And Ephraim, that's northern Israel, said, surely I've become rich, I have found wealth. See, that's all that matters. Money, but not justice. And the wealth was ill-gotten because there were false balances, which means there's commercial cheating going on. But despite the fact that they're cheating, getting rich by cheating, Ephraim says, in all my labors, they will find in me no iniquity. People will find in me no iniquity. I didn't do anything wrong. They were actually doing a lot of iniquity, but they wouldn't admit it. We go now to Hosea chapter 12, verses 9 through 10. But I have been the Lord your God since the land of Egypt, Yahweh continues. I will make you live in tents again, as in the days of the appointed festival. I have also spoken to the prophets, and I gave numerous visions. And through the prophets, I gave parables. In other words, you don't have an excuse. I've been speaking to you, and you guys haven't been listening. And so I'm going to make you live in tents again. Now, what's that a reference to? Well, a couple of options. One from John Gill. Option number one, God is going to make Ephraim live again as on the Feast of Tabernacles. Actually, the text says that right here in verse 9, I will make you live in tents again, as in the days of the appointed festival. That would be the Feast of Tabernacles, when people lived in tents. The Feast of Tents, the Feast of Tabernacles. Or it could be, this is my speculation, that Hosea is saying, Yahweh is saying, I'm going to make you live in tents again like you lived in the wilderness on the Exodus when you were traveling through the wilderness for those 40 years and you had to live in tents. Well, whatever it's referring to, it's a bad thing because, as Adam Clark says, the northern Israelites and the people of Judah will be ripped out of their permanent homes and will be living in exile in tents. Verse 10, Yahweh says, I've also spoken to the prophets. He gave visions to the prophets and parables to the prophets. Now, I compiled a list of all the prophets who ministered to the northern kingdom since Jeroboam I, who ruled between 931 and 910, all the way up to Hosea's time. In the time of Jeroboam I, ruled 931 to 910, we have Ahijah. In the time of Omri, 885 to 874, and Ahab, 874 to 853, we have Elijah. In the time of Omri, 885 to 874, and Ahab, 874 to 853, we've got Micaiah. In the time of King Joram, 852 to 841, we have Elisha. In the time of Kings Jehoahaz, 814 to 798, Jehoash, 798 to 782, and Jeroboam II, 782 to 753, we've got Jonah. And during the time of those same three kings, we have Amos and Hosea. So right on up to about 753, we have these prophets prophesying, telling the northern Israelites to come back, but all to no avail, because in 722, right after the time of Hosea, the northern kingdom went down to the Assyrians, to Shalmaneser V. So we go now to Hosea 12, verses 11 through 14, and we will finish this chapter. Yahweh continues to speak, or maybe Hosea is speaking now, doesn't matter. Is there iniquity in Gilead? Surely they are worthless. In Gilgal they sacrifice bulls. Yes, their altars are like the stone heaps beside the furrows of the field. Now Jacob fled to the land of Aram, that's Syria, and Israel worked for a wife, and for a wife he kept sheep. But by a prophet the Lord brought Israel from Egypt, and by a prophet he was kept. Ephraim has provoked to bitter anger, so his Lord, and that's Lord in lower case, will leave his blood guilt on him and bring back his reproach to him. Now this verse is going to require a little bit of explanation. It's not immediately obvious as we read it. First of all, is there iniquity in Gilead? Now Gilead is that strip of land east of the Jordan from the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee to the northern tip of the Dead Sea. Now, what is Hosea referring to here? Well, I've got four options. He could stand for all of that land that I just mentioned to the east of the Jordan River. Barnes holds to that view. Wikipedia mentions it as an option. Or it could be a town of Gilead that Hosea has already singled out for reprobation. Back in Hosea chapter 6, verses 8 through 9, Hosea says, Gilead is a city of evildoers, tracked with bloody footprints. Well, of course, that doesn't tell us what city it is, but it does say it's a city that's evil. And as the Cambridge commentator points out, the punishment of this Gilead is recorded for us in 2 Kings 15:29. In the days of Pekah, rule 740 to 732, king of Israel, Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came and captured Ayon, Abel-Beth-Makkah, Yanoah, Kadesh, Hazor, Gilead, and Galilee. So Gilead's a town that's captured. All the land of Naphtali. It's a town in Naphtali, the northern province there, to the north of the Sea of Galilee, and deported the people to Assyria. So it could be that particular northern city of Gilead. Wikipedia mentions option number three. It could be Ramoth-Gilead, which is a town to the east of the Jordan River, famous city mentioned in the Book of Kings, and or it could be Jabesh-Gilead, another town, I think further to the south, another option by Wikipedia. But whatever it is, there's iniquity there. It's obvious. There's idols everywhere. Is there iniquity in Gilead? Surely they are worthless. The people of Gilead are worthless, and if it's referring to the whole region, well, the whole region's worthless. In Gilgal, they sacrifice bulls. Now, what are the options for Gilgal? Option number one, it stands for all the land to the west of the Jordan. This is Albert Barnes' idea. Or it could be a particular city named Gilgal to the west of the Jordan. BibleAtlas.org has three Gilgals, but all of them have question marks, so apparently nobody really knows where Gilgal is. So I'm just going to say that Gilead is referring to the east of the Jordan, and in Gilgal is referring to the west of the Jordan. If it's a particular city, the statement is not quite as strong, but it's the same idea. Yes, their altars are like the stone heaps beside the furrows of the field. Now, what does that refer to? Farmers would pull rocks out of the furrows and place them beside the furrow, as the Cambridge commentator says, and so there would be rocks all along a plowed field, and there would be lots of stone heaps, and the stone altars to the idol gods would be likewise numerous, plentiful. Now, in verse 12, Jacob is mentioned again, the forefather Jacob, the patriarch Jacob. Now, Jacob fled to the land of Aram, that's Syria, to the north and east of Israel. Now, Jacob fled to the land of Aram and Israel, that's Jacob, that's his other name. Jacob means deceiver, Israel means struggle. He struggled in the womb. And Israel worked for a wife. Now, the first wife he worked for, of course, was Leah. He thought he was working for Rachel, but he ended up with Leah. And for a wife, he kept sheep, so I'm not going to worry about which wife it was. He was working there in Aram in Syria, and that shows his low-down, diminished estate. So what Hosea is trying to do here, he says, look, in the beginning, I prophesied great things about Jacob. His life portended great things. He grabbed Esau by the heel, grabbing for the birthright. He wrestled with the angel of Jehovah. He had a vision of Jacob's ladder, and the promises of Abraham were repeated to him, land, offspring, and blessings that will cover the earth. That's how he started out, but look at him now, this pathetic kingdom of northern Israel. And to illustrate that low state, he says, all these wonderful promises to Jacob, but then he ends up basically an indentured servant in the pagan land of Syria. Had to work for 14 years. And so this is a reference by Hosea to the degraded state of Jacob, referring, of course, to the degraded state of northern Israel in the 8th century B.C. In verse 13, Hosea says, but by a prophet the Lord brought Israel from Egypt. Now here Hosea is trying to point out the ministry of the prophets, which have been ignored by northern Israel. I've already mentioned all the prophets that prophesied to the northern kingdom. In verse 10, I have also spoken to the prophets. I gave numerous visions, and through the prophets I gave parables. And now in verse 13, by a prophet the Lord brought Israel from Egypt. In other words, prophets gave Israel deliverance, northern Israel. And if you guys in Ephraim in the 8th century B.C. would like to be saved from Assyria, maybe you better listen to me, Hosea, because I'm a prophet too. By a prophet the Lord brought Israel from Egypt, and that prophet was Moses. How do we know Moses was a prophet? Because of this famous verse in Deuteronomy 18:18. I, referring to Yahweh, will raise up for them a prophet like you, Moses. And of course, this is a prophecy of Jesus. I will raise up for the Israelites a prophet like you, Moses, from among their brothers, from among the Jews. And Jesus was from the Jews. And so Hosea says, by a prophet, i.e. Moses, the Lord brought Israel from Egypt, because Moses led the people of Israel from Egypt into the Promised Land, or almost into the Promised Land. And by a prophet he was kept. That second prophet that kept Israel could refer to Joshua, because he was the successor of Moses, or it could just refer to Moses again, a repeat, because Moses kept the Israelites. If it refers to Joshua, there's a small problem, because Joshua is never called a prophet in Scripture. However, Joshua did many things that showed that he functioned as a prophet, as the Bible scholar Jonathan J. Routley said in an article in the Journal of Evangelical Theological Society, convincing me that, yes, Joshua was a prophet just like Moses was. So it's ambiguous. Verse 13, by a prophet the Lord brought Israel from Egypt. That's clearly Moses, and by a prophet he was kept, either by Moses or by Joshua. Verse 14, Ephraim has provoked to bitter anger. Now getting back to the present, Hosea's present, 8th century B.C., Hosea is again trying to draw contrast between what God had done for Israel in the past, what God had done for Jacob in the past, deliverance. But now God is provoked to bitter anger. So his Lord will leave his blood guilt on him. Now that Lord there is not Yahweh. It's not uppercase L-O-R-D. It's lowercase L-O-R-D. And so that could refer to Assyria is the Lord of Israel who will leave Israel's blood guilt on Israel. Poole makes that point, but Poole also says it might refer to Yahweh. Either way, Israel's going to have blood guilt on his head, blood guiltiness on his head. Why? Well, because of the manifold sins that northern Israel was committing. Now at the end of verse 14, this is the New American Standard, the Lord will bring back Israel's reproach to Israel. That's not really clear. Let me read you from the Holman Christian Study Bible. Ephraim has provoked bitter anger, so his Lord, lowercase l, will leave his blood guilt on him, on Israel, and repay him for his contempt. That's a little more straightforward. Bring back his reproach to him is not nearly as clear as God's going to repay you, northern Israel, for your contempt of me. And of course that happened when the Assyrians conquered northern Israel in 722. Now, let me go back and pick up something I omitted here in verse 13. But by a prophet the Lord brought Israel from Egypt. I already mentioned that Hosea is mentioning prophets as somebody that the Israelites should be listening to. But also by mentioning the fact that Israel was in Egypt, that shows in what a low estate they had fallen. And that would remind the northern Israelites, hey, you guys are in just as bad a shape. You're in trouble. You need to be listening to the prophet. You need to be listening to me, Hosea. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished our discussion of Hosea chapter 12. We are now ready to go to Hosea 13, which I will entitle The Lord's Relentless Judgment on Israel. More of the same. Hellfire and damnation. Well-deserved hellfire and damnation. I hope to see you in our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.